Support for the Forward's Bentil Brief podcast comes from listeners like you and from Edward Blank, whose generosity makes this program possible.
Hi, I'm Lynn Harris.
And I'm Gina Green.
And this is A Bentil Brief, the Jewish Advice Podcast. So recently we did this cool event where we did advice and we did it live.
And now you can hear the recorded version of Bentil Live. We hope you enjoy it as much as we did. You can also leave your questions with us by emailing bentil@forward.com. That's B-I-N-T-E-L at forward.com. Or giving us a call and leaving us a message at 201-540-9728.
Alrighty then, I think we could get started. Welcome everyone. I'm Jody Rudoran. I'm editor-in-chief of The Forward, and I'm so excited to have with us three amazing women, the co-hosts of our exciting new Bentil Brief podcast, Lynn Harris and Gina Green, and The Forward's archivist, Hannah Pollack. Gina is in the middle of a Musar retreat at the Isabella Friedman Retreat Center. So she is very self-actualized and ready to talk about all kinds of character traits and deep spiritual things. Lynn is camping out in her son's bedroom in Brooklyn, which looks amazing. That was a little bit of a secret.
And Hannah is... Lynn, hold on, Jody. Lynn, is that really, you remade the bedroom for today?
I remade this area of the bedroom.
Love it.
Want to know what is going on outside this area of the bedroom. That's all.
It is actually, right after this call, I'm going to go propose that Lynn do a podcast on just designing your room for this square. And then we have Hannah, who is in the old country. She's up in the Catskills. Very exciting. So, you know, I've been editor of The Forward for 2 years, almost exactly. And when I came in, there were two big things I really wanted to do and was kind of charged with. One was create an awesome podcast. And the other one was revive the Bentil Brief. And so I killed two birds with one stone. No, I'm so excited that we were able to achieve this. And brought this amazing group of women together. So we're going to tell you a little bit about the podcast and about our hosts. Hannah's going to tell you a lot of history of Bentil. All three of them are going to talk about what it's been like to make this podcast. And then we are going to answer live some questions. We have some really great questions that you sent in. I was a little dubious about the send in questions when you register thing, but we basically have a whole new next season of the podcast in our inboxes. So I'm really thrilled with that. So just to tell you a tiny bit of background, A Bentil Brief, your Jewish advice podcast, launched at the end of July. We have literally just today finished editing, I believe, the 10th episode of the first season. It will be in your podcast apps on Thursday. And then we're going to take a brief break. And although there are wonderful 10 episodes for you to revel in, they're all kind of evergreen thematic advice chats. And we're hoping to be back for a second season real soon. If you have not already, or really even if you have, I would love for you to take out your phones right now and go to your podcast app and subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. That would be really wonderful. And while you are doing that, we are going to have Gina and Lynn tell you a little bit about each other. So I like to make them introduce each other. Lynn Harris, you have been an advice columnist. You have been a teacher of comedy and a comedian, teacher of comedy, particularly of women and girls. You are a writer, an activist, a mother, a friend. Tell us why Gina Green is someone you would go to for advice.
At this point, I'm ready to like go on Etsy and get them to make me a bracelet that just says WWGD for what would Gina do? Gina is basically like she's a strategist by day. Like that's her work and her like her life's work. And she is just as strategic about, you can tell that like she's, it's not just a job. Like you can tell that this is like her, her orientation is the world, is what is the problem and how can we fix it? But not just from a practical way, also from just a great depth of compassion. So it's like, how can we fix this problem in such a way that maybe even contributes to fixing the world? Mm-hmm. So what would Gina do?
Love that.
Always ask.
We are going to be marketing those bracelets very soon, I'm sure. Gina Green, you are, as Lynn said, a writer and an activist and a strategist and a consultant. You've been on the boards of so many Jewish and other organizations, too many to name. You like to say you're born, raised, and returned to South Carolina. You recently sent your first son off to college. You've got three other kids at home. You are a champion Bananagrams and Scrabble meister. I have a new game to teach you, by the way, that's off of Bananagrams. And I really want to talk to everybody about Spelling Bee. If you're not doing it on the New York Times app, you should be. Ooh. But anyway, Gina Green, tell us about why you go to Lynn Harris for advice these days.
Because she's just good at it. Like she's been doing it. She's been on the block. And also I happen to know that it's in her blood and in her bones. Lynn invokes her mom, Florence, and the sage advice that she gave. I think she got it genetically and then got it also from the air, because Lynn brings so much compassion and love for people and love for doing what's right to advice giving, and really sits that at its core. Like, how do we do right by people? And I think that you give really good advice to folks when you can see them as full, whole people.
Hannah Pollack has been at The Forward for 21 years. She manages our archive. She curates exhibits. She curates our program on an app called Urban Archive, which has storytelling. She is in charge of all things historical at The Forward. She is constantly being called on to either help our journalists figure out something about The Forward's past that's relevant to today's news, or asked by some individual to chase down some personal history. She does it all. She's brilliant. She's creative. She's thoughtful. And she has been a student of the Bintel Brief for many, many years. The Bintel Brief was founded in 1906. It was originally written by the founding editor of The Forward, answered by Ab Kahan, lasted all the way into the 70s or 80s with different writers, has been collected into numerous books, has been made into plays. And now Hannah has been a featured and frequent guest on the podcast version. I'd like you to tell us a little bit, Hannah, about how this new incarnation of Bintel kind of sits with you and fits into that history, because you know so much of that history.
Oh, wow. Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for that introduction. I want to kind of like just flip for a second back to 1906, because there's this, in the original inaugural introduction of the Bintel in 1906, January 1906, Ab Kahn wrote this little précis, sort of opening his heart and telling people, you know, what was in it for him, like what happened, you know? And up until that point, let's just say that The Forward was primarily interested in educating readers politically, listening to issues that were going on in the city and in the country from a political standpoint, from a Jewish political standpoint, from an international, okay? But his idea always was to make it essential to the readers. In other words, to bring, like, just like what we're doing today, actually, to bring feature, what we would call feature items, to bring anything of interest to the reader. In other words, he wasn't interested in coming from above, especially as somebody who was a notable political leader himself and an activist in the socialist progressive movements. He wasn't interested in coming from above. And in fact, he was so interested in both linguistically using Yiddish, but regular everyday on the streets, the Lower East Side Yiddish, that he was sometimes taken to task for it, but that was one of his motives. And I believe that was kind of like a little bit behind, you know, why he was so interested in starting the Bintel Brief, because that was like almost his first, we're going to do a DIY. We're going to bring the readers, yeah, you know, into the paper. That was kind of his
thing. I'm so glad you mentioned that. And I mean, really, I want to just, there's something kind of astounding about how this happened, because The Forward, so it was founded in 1897. And in those early years was, you know, it was founded as a newspaper, but it was really like, it very quickly became this community hub. And there were like people would come to the building. They came on election nights to watch returns for decades going on. And they wrote to the foreword, like, for help or for information. Yeah. I mean, it really went to, and then it was eventually that this buildup of letters, there was this notion of like, I guess we should answer them and we should answer them publicly or whatever. And I'm fascinated to think about that because we talk a lot about how the podcast, the idea of the podcast is part of us making the forward digital and modern and, you know, on the, in the modes that people consume media today. But I think there's this really interesting aspect that I want to ask you about, which is this question of community. So clearly the forward in its early days was a community newspaper, community news organization in the most essential way. And I really believe we can do that again, but it's a cut, like we live in this world where all these communities are fractured and polarized and the whole definition of community is kind of up for grabs. And you guys have dealt with this actually directly in one of the episodes, but I wonder what you think about that, how you guys have been thinking about that question of like, how can you use the podcast to bring some of that idea of community that was so essential to the forward's creation?
I think I just ask people to start coming to your building.
Right. I was just going to say that is really critical. Like it's a joke, but it's like kind of not a joke, is that the forward building was open 24/7. And people did actually, even before the Bintel Brief was started, we had a feature called Poste Restante, which is basically like mailbox. Like you could actually have your mail sent to the building. So put those two things together, the building being open 24/7, meaning it really was meant to be the address of the Jewish people, and they took it literally, and people needed help at the very, very basic level. So take that idea and take the 24/7 idea.
Yeah, we're open 24/7. The internet's on.
Exactly.
Not Facebook. Not Facebook.
Right.
Not Instagram. Not today.
Yeah, it's like the elevator broke in the old forward building and you couldn't get up to the ninth floor. So what do you do?
But I mean, obviously, it's a different project today. I mean, the forward of those days was teaching people how to be Americans. We talk about this a lot. So how do you bring that into that 21st century podcast?
I have a question for Hannah. Do you know an American history where a Bintel Brief sits in advice columns?
Right. Let's just say it was not the first advice. I think the first actual advice column in the world was like in the 1600s. But flash forward to the modern era, I believe he was the first to do it in a Yiddish newspaper. And I believe he was possibly the first to take on these topics. In other words, what editor Jane Eisner used to call like the granular level, the forward mm-hmm. spoke to the people. The Bintel Brief was, and I'll just quote you, Khan, from that intro column. I had always wished that the forward would receive stories from daily life, dramas, mm-hmm. comedies, or truly curious events that weren't written at a desk, but rather in the tenements and factories and cafes. Everywhere that life was the author of the drama. So, you know, that's
life was the author of the drama.
And I think, Jody, your question about how to make it modern, right? Like part of it now is like, what are the types of questions that get answered, that get asked, that people need help with now? This isn't the same country that it was in 1906, but if you listen to the episodes that Hannah has joined us for, you know these questions are universal. They're not going anywhere anytime soon. Friends, family, love, money, like it's all perennial, which is what makes
it timeless. How to mute yourself on Zoom, you know, those are the questions. I want to say about the history, it's worth noting, Dear Abby started in 1956. Right. That's 50 years after a Bintel Brief. So, and there's clear evidence, right, that the modern newspaper advice column owes a lot to Bintel. I want to get back to this community idea. Do you feel like what you're doing on the podcast is connected at all to the, is it community building? Is that at all part of it?
I think it could be in terms of it's conversation building. And there's a thought process, of course, also that we go through when we think about who should we ask about this? Who do we invite into the conversation? What guests do we want to have on? You know, who do we want to have at the dinner table for this conversation? Certainly, we always start with Hannah, obviously. But after that, I mean, that's just a small point, but I think that's definitely part of it. It's not just what do Lynn and Gina think. It's who can Lynn and Gina, to use an overused word, curate to widen the conversation. And then I don't know. I also think it would be fun to figure out other ways to use the magic of the interwebs to continue the conversation elsewhere. That's for season two, to really generate, like, what do you think? But I think the other way that there's sort of an ineffable way that this creates community, which is that the magic of these questions, we've talked about how they're timeless. The magic of these questions is really their stories, right? Because we're not like on call advice givers. We may not be able to help someone in the moment, but it's really about the story that they're telling. And there's this sort of an ineffable way that community is created because everyone has the specific circumstances to their story, but there's always something primal. And what are those primal themes that everyone can relate to? So it's the relate, like, I think that's why people like not just this, but like any advice column or, you know, anything like this, because they can relate to the story. And that doesn't build a community in the way that, like, you know, people are knocking on the door of the forward kind of way, or, you know, sitting around a table way, but there's something to that. There is that relatedness that gets built.
So take us behind the scenes a little bit. Tell us a little bit of the insider scoop. I know, Lynn, you usually record from your laundry room. That's one of the
or my kids' room when I'm lucky. Now that school started, I can be back in my kids' room, which is so much better than my laundry room. It's, first of all, it's 30 degrees cooler, but also messier.
But how do you pick the questions? How do you decide what to say about them? How much research are you doing? Like, tell us a little bit. Gina, why don't you start? But like, how does it work? How do you make this thing?
Yeah, so, you know, we were kind of building the plane as we were flying it, right? Like, we wanted to do this podcast, and we had to first get some questions. And the first thing when we want to give advice is to have people who are asking for it, right? So we got some few, we cultivated, curated, tried to bring in some questions, and then we look for ones that are going to have broad appeal, right? Like Lynn was saying, you know, everyone has specific stories, but we want to be able to find the question that we can tease out sort of the micro and the macro, ones that can, you know, touch upon, allow us to bring in, weave in Jewish wisdom and Jewish life and Jewish living to it, although that's every question, but we want to look for these things and look for themes and questions that are going to allow multiple people, multiple lives, multiple identities to be able to appreciate and see something in it. So I think that those are really the key pieces. And I'll tell you also that I started recording from my closet, Lynn, which I think might beat your laundry room in terms of the heat. Because once that door closes, all of those blankets and towels make it really hot in there.
Yeah, it's a pillow fort. It's a pillow fort.
And our producer says it's the best place for recording.
Good to know. I asked you guys this the other day, but I want to ask it again. So what makes this podcast, what makes it Jewish advice? Like, you know, in the old days when Abraham was doing it, it was in Yiddish. Clearly the readership was clearly all Jews. And it was this specific thing, the connective tissue here, right? Was this huge amount of people were coming from one kind of society to a new one. And they were trying to figure that out. And now we have, you know, complex interlocking identities and communities, and there's not as clear, like, we're doing this thing and we're trying to become like this. So what makes for Jewish advice? Why do we need a Jewish advice podcast, and what makes it Jewish?
We love this one. So one thing, there are many things, but one thing is, I think, focus on the text. When we look at a letter, you know, we often look at what's not being said. We look at what's not being asked. We look at word choices. We noticed, Gina actually noticed in the very first one that we answered, like we got to the end of it, we were talking, Gina goes, he never actually asked a question. So that started a whole new thing, like, well, what does he want? What does he mean? What does he need? Like, then we read into that and that got interesting, you know? So all the marginalia, you know, all of the close reading, all of that sort of nerdery, I find to be, it's not a uniquely Jewish approach, but it is a Jewish approach for sure. So that's one thing. We got more, but that's one thing that I really love about it.
And I do think that we also bring like an actual lived Jewish lives and lived Jewish experience and Jewish history. And we bring in Jewish texts sometimes. And I know Lynn was, I think it's almost Talmudic kind of what we do and with the reading and with the discussion and with the back and forth and with the, hey, no, wait, that's not right. Wait, maybe it is. And that, you know, it's funny. I will say that, like I said, you know, we just launched this at the end of July. And one of the things we sort of figured out, and we're really getting into behind the scenes here, we started out and it was like, okay, we're recording the first couple of episodes. And I think we did not enough thinking or planning about how the episode would roll necessarily. And then I think we might do a little bit too much planning. There's a happy medium because what y'all get is about half an hour of us talking to our guests, talking to each other, talking to Hannah, but we record a lot more than that. And so we're trying to make an episode that is meaningful, that is succinct, that takes people on a story and on a journey, that brings in history, that brings in the present, and really gives folks advice that, like Lynn said, you might not be able to use in the minute, because when you leave the question on our Bentle voicemail number, by the time we answer it, you might have already had your the need may have already passed. But everyone can listen and everyone can take away from it what they will, because we choose questions that that's possible for.
Hannah, I have a couple things I want to ask you about, and then we're going to turn to some of the questions. I want to go back a little bit to what I asked you earlier, which is sort of, so, you know, I talk all the time about how do we preserve the tradition and the core mission of the Forward, but develop new habits of kind of for what audiences need today. And I'm really interested in your thoughts on sort of how this incarnation of the Bentle, you know, fits in, how it's different, how it's connected to the history. And then maybe you can go from there to talk a little bit about, you know, you've actually been creating those connections on several episodes of the podcast by finding letters that, it's interesting, they're very rarely like, oh, here's the situation, here the same. No, they're really different, but you're finding like interesting thematic connections.
Yeah. Wow, so much to say on that. I mean, a little bit, I just want to, like, you know, one thing Khan said in that first inaugural Bentle brief was he said that he accepted three letters for it, and all three were of a personal nature rather than a communal one. So I think that's kind of really instructive, because in a sense, that is what the Forward does. It's like, it is a community, right? Where on the one hand, we say we're like the mirror of the Jewish people. We mirror the world to the Jewish people. We mirror the Jewish people to the world. There's lots of that kind of like from the singular to, you know, to the communal, to the world. And I think that is kind of what I'm hearing in this podcast, that even when people come with a very specific personal, you know, issue, like the time we were talking about the QAnon relatives, if people remember that issue, like there was, like you're saying, there is sort of a more communal kind of picture to that, right? How does it affect all of us right now in at this moment in time? But then there's also like a really specific, this is happening to a Jewish person. They are approaching a Jewish media organization to have that question answered that has this history, right? This bridge of 124 years or slightly less from 1906 to 2021, like giving advice in a myriad of variations, you know? So a little bit also, just to push the analogy a little bit, you know, over time, it's true, the Bentle kind of like, you know, in the 80s, Isaac Metzger, the last journalist who was tasked with answering it, he passed away, not after having done two volumes of the Bentle and five Yiddish novels and, you know, he really gave his all to the Bentle. But then they, you know, in a couple of reiterations before Digital Land, they decided to have guest columnists, you know? So it's like other prominent Jews giving advice to other Jewish advice seekers. And, you know, Ed Koch like factored in at one point. So, you know, there is this idea, I think, generally speaking, that people do turn to the Jewish paper for some kind, I don't want to say like practical, but it's like no nonsense, a little bit that no nonsense truth and wisdom.
Very, very interesting. Okay, I am going to turn now to some of these questions we have, which are the kinds of questions we answer on the Bentle brief, real life dilemmas. But I'm going to read now, Gina and Lynn, you get a break. You normally read these questions, but I am going to read them. Sorry, we've got one. Here we go. Dear Bentle, I've been working from home since the start of the pandemic with a partner who is also working from home, but has a more taxing work schedule. I've taken over about 90% of the household chores, and I'm tired of it. How do I convince my partner to pitch in more? His work schedule is always the excuse, but I can't keep going on like this. Please help.
You know, I just think it's amazing how the pandemic has surfaced questions that no one has ever asked before.
But Lynn, but the letter writer says that they have taken over
all
of these duties. My first question was, what was it like before? Was it a 50-50 split? Did something happen with the pandemic that did something change in the scenario and the circumstances that put the letter writer in a position to be now holding 90% of the work? So like, I think there's like an assessment that needs to happen here. Like what's different from March 2020 to November, or wait, we're not in November yet, October 21. Right. So
is the partner a frontline worker?
Correct.
That would be relevant.
Yes.
But I think that the letter writer would have stated that if he.
One of the things when I read it, I was thinking, I think this is a great question. What has changed? Obviously, there's always a need to share and balance and communicate around it. I was reading it for some reason and thinking about there are ways in which there's much more stuff to do around the house when everybody's home. So I was reading it.
You notice it more. You can't watch.
I was just thinking, I mean, there's also less to do in other ways sometimes, especially with kids. But I was thinking that was what it was about, was this kind of, there was all these new chores to do. There's like more home cooking or whatever. So that was one of the reasons that I was thinking maybe it was a change.
Hmm.
Or maybe they seem equally available for home chores because they're both working at home.
Right. So then, but then that brings me to the reason why the fact that it had changed resonated for me is because the question the letter writer, the verb that they used was, how do I convince my partner? And it's like, but if you were doing it before, if it was a more even split before, then how did you arrive at that division of labor then? Which, Jody, you alluded to, you gotta have a conversation. You gotta talk about what needs to get done. You gotta talk about who does what better. I hate loading the dishwasher. In fact, I'm kind of juvenile in that I'll just like load it sometimes and know that my husband's gonna come behind me and fix my damage, right? So like I don't consider myself the primary dishwashing machine loader. That's my kids and my husband. So like they kind of figure out like what makes sense. What are the tasks in this era of increased chores or different types of chores? What are the tasks that can fit into the partner's taxing schedule? Are there things that they can do at 3 a.m.
to say? So I am the primary cook and my husband is the primary dishwasher, which includes loading the dishwasher. But I do occasionally jump in, especially, you know, when he might have something else. And the thing I cannot stand is when he comes behind me and changes the way I've loaded the dishwasher or comments and criticizes about and wants to talk about the optimal way to load the dishwasher. So you are clearly farther along in your journey, Gina, to embrace that kind of help, because I am not ready to. It's like, you can load the dishwasher or you can let me load it how I want.
But then why do you load it is the thing. Like, if you know you can't do it as well as Gary can.
I didn't say I couldn't do it as well as he can. I said he thinks that I
can. Well, I'm just saying, if someone can get behind, there is an optimal way to load dishwashers.
Yes, okay, but reasonable people can disagree.
Yeah.
Clear, Jody did not send in this question.
My questions were filtered out. Hannah, I believe you have a question from the 1918 pandemic to share with us.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
It's about the dishwasher, I'm sure.
Well, in a way it is. Like, I'm so glad you put it in there with it, because in a way it is. And I was wondering about that with Gina's question too, which made me think that this is analogous, because it's about like, what do you do with that moment where there's the disagreement? I mean, like, you know, who wants to load and how are you going to, negotiation is one thing, but what about that hot, that moment where you're like, oh, who am I with? Like, how did this, you know? So this is about like,
how can I make a life with someone who disagrees with me about how to load the dishwasher?
Exactly. That moment is really hard to get through. And those are, a lot of times, those are the bintles. The bintles are those moments. There's no negotiating it. They don't know how to talk, you know, it's like they're willing to pour their heart out publicly about a private thing, which is a big deal for people in, you know, the early years. It's a little easier for us now, right? That is part of social media. And also, let's say our movement through time as American Jews, right? So we're a little more comfortable seeing ourselves reflected. Okay. So these folks, and it is a little bit gender reversed, I said, because it's the man who is now sick with consumption, like TB, and he is just like at his wit's end, And I'll just give you an idea. And he had met his partner. He met his wife at a socialist union kind of thing. So he just assumed she was woke, and they get married, and, you know, she gets sick. He takes care of her forever. And then, you know, reverse happens. And, you know, he gets sick. And here's how he describes what his situation is and why he's just like at his wit's end. I'm lying here alone in the house. There's nobody to even offer me a glass of water. My wife goes out for hours, and when she returns and I ask why she has no compassion for me, she answers that she's not obliged to care for a sick husband. And that's after I gave up everything for her, rescued her from, you know, she was at death's door. I lie in bed and bitter tears flow from my eye. What did I do to deserve this? How can a person be so awful? So interesting for me was actually the response, because they absolutely had no patience for the partner who would not participate in the partnership, especially huge insult for the forward is that the fact that the folks met at like a socialist kind of thing. So they were like, he spared whoever wrote this, and it wasn't always Obcon, we know. So whoever got tasked with writing this, I think it did have to pass Khan's desk, I'm imagining, because they were like, what a tragedy, the devil would behave no worse, you know. And but the writer need not be so hard up. First of all, he should get well and then understand what is to be done. The woman, through her behavior, has exhibited her true character. She's shown that not only is she unworthy of partnership, but not even of, and I don't know why they went to this place, but not even of being employed as a domestic. Why? Because in their idea, somebody who was working, you know, in domestic service as a maid or, you know, a butler would be more loyal mm-hmm. to their employer. So they did kind of look at it from like a work, right? A labor perspective. It's like fair, come on. So I just thought that was kind of related to what we were talking about with the tasks.
So as Lynn alluded to, this question, I mean, this was a very common feminist, post-feminist question of like, so what is the best way of going at dividing the work? And Gina alluded to this in her talking about the dishwasher, because one of the strategies is, of course, like figure out what you're good at, what you hate most. But both Lynn, Gina, what is your advice on how one best goes about, pandemic or no, figuring out who should do what to make the family run? Because there's a lot of stuff nobody wants to do, in my experience.
Right, and someone's going to have to do it. Yes. And I think pulling in from the letter that Hannah just read, I mean, there is no way to talk about this question. The question started out about partnership and then it went into gender, right? So there's no way, I don't know the gender of the letter writer, but or do we? We don't think we do.
Well, we know the partner is a man. We don't know what the letter is.
Right. Exactly. We don't know the current question. There's no way to talk about this conversation without talking about gender. And I was hopeful for a second because it was started out as I'm going to answer your question, Jody, but it started out with the language of partnership. And then all of a sudden it was like, no, we're going to say this woman, you know, so, okay. But I think there is no denying that whatever the permutation of a given couple, and in fact, there is no denying because statistics bear it out, you know, that we still live in a society where, you know, women not only spend more hours, men are spending more hours, but women are still up here doing stuff. But then there's the factor of the emotional labor. It's not just execution, it's management, you know, organizing what needs to be done. So it's not just like, hey, I checked off a thing. It's like, yeah, but who knew that we had to do the thing? So I think that in most of these cases, I mean, depending on the gender permutation of the couple, whatever, whether it's a gender thing or a personality thing, to go back to Gina, what Gina was saying, it's to kind of go back and dig in and evaluate who's better at what, you know, who naturally enjoys the thing better, not that it's all going to be fun. Because we do that in my house. Like I do things that are like, my husband doesn't do tech. He does a lot of other great things, just not tech. So like we're not going to make him do the tech things. That's stupid. It doesn't get done. So figuring out who's better at what, allocating it that way in a way that doesn't frustrate either person. And then figuring out that, well, it turns out there's a whole lot of other stuff that nobody wants to do, but sorry. And then just trying to get at whatever the resistance is, and then then also being kind of like, your resistance doesn't matter that much because it has to get done, and figuring out where the openings are for that. Yeah, that's my advice. Have a conversation. Get it out. You know, it's really weird because we never say that, Gina. We never say, talk to the person.
Never.
But you know, it's go talk to the person. And but I think you can't convince is the wrong verb. If you get back to the text, convince, and all those words like convince, fair share, blah, blah, blah. It's go back to the basics. We are a partnership. How are we gonna?
I mean, this sounds good, Lynn, but I have to say, I don't know.
I want to add to that because I think that needs to happen. And then I also think if it is within your means, throw some money at the problem. If it's within your means, get some help to help you with some of these chores.
Yeah. You're
both working really hard. Like, maybe part of that assessment is, can we get some support and some help to help with this, because none of us want more on our shoulders in a pandemic. And the other thing is, if you've got some kids around the house, figure out how to like get them in the mix. Like, we've gotten better during the pandemic with, you know, giving our kids chores that are different than what they may have done before. Because like you said, Jody, there are more things to do. We've broken so many dishes in the last year and a half because we're constantly eating on them, right? And so like there is a lot more stuff to do because we're home. And so I think getting those kids in the mix too, how can they help lessen the load if you've got one old enough to do stuff? Look, our 6-year-old knows how to load the dishwasher better than I do.
So everybody does apparently.
It's a low bar, but.
So you would not recommend, say, domestic strike. You don't recommend that she or he just stop cleaning up after him and just let the mess pile up, or that she literally go on strike.
It doesn't solve the root problem. Everyone just gets annoyed and it's passive aggressive. And
if they're anything like me, that actually, it not getting done is going to give me more angst and more anxiety and more frustration to see that it's not getting done.
I mean, what I was going to say about Lynn, I mean, I think Lynn has laid out like the dream framework, but I do think the reality is it is often the case that one partner is better at more things or cares more about things being done in a certain way. And so this idea that we can just kind of meet with this perfect 50-50, according to her ability.
Well, it's not going to be 50-50. I do think it should still be a little communist. Like, it still should be a little each according to what they can do. But I do think there is that there. Like, my husband's like, listen, we go to doctor's appointments, teacher-parent conferences, and he's like, if you want an email to get a response, send it, like, make sure my wife gets it, because he is going to be terrible on email. And I just think that there is so much to leaning into the things that someone can do. And it's not going to be 50-50, because some of the stuff I do is actually more important than the dishes getting washed. Like, me making sure that the doctor gets emailed is more important than making sure the dishwasher runs every day. So it's not going to be a 50-50 split, but having that conversation about what matters, what's important, what do I do best, helps us figure that out.
And the letter writer also has to decide to let go of what really matters and what doesn't, right? What will actually happen if X, Y, Z doesn't happen? If X doesn't happen, that's a problem. If Y and Z, it wouldn't be her way, but the world's not gonna end.
I'm gonna move us on to another question. And I'm actually going to be really interested first in Gina and Lynn's, who are moms like me, and then also very interested in Hannah's perspective. Here it is. My daughter has been growing apart from a girl with whom she's been friends for a few years. The mom keeps reaching out for playdates and sleepovers, and my daughter has no interest. I feel badly since I know this child suffers socially and doesn't have many friends. Do I encourage my daughter to play with her, tell the mom the truth, or keep saying no until she gets the hint? It's painful.
I know.
Painful. And I could have actually written this letter, Jody. I, in fact, just got a Facebook message from a friend, the mother of a friend, a former friend of my daughter, who's in middle school, saying, you know, this child lost my daughter's cell phone number. She misses her. Can I give it to her? And as soon as I saw who it was, I was like, ooh, I got a little tense in my gut because I knew that my daughter was not going to want to have another sleepover or make connection again or reconnect. And so I said, I was like, okay, Tsipora, do you want, what do you want me to give her your number? And she thought about it for about 2 seconds and said no. And the thing, and I actually have not written the mother back yet, because what's important to me is that that little girl doesn't think that my daughter not wanting to reconnect and not wanting to recultivate this friendship is about her. I don't want that little girl to walk away thinking, oh, Tsipora doesn't like me anymore. Something is wrong with me. We used to be so tight. So I'm actually in the middle of trying to figure out how do I give an honest answer to this mom that's not going to hurt her daughter and is also not going to throw my daughter under the bus for feelings that are naturally occurring to her. You know, she isn't in a tizzy about this, right? Like this isn't burning her up. Like she's like, I don't want that relationship anymore. So I'm in the process right now myself of formulating what exactly do I say to this family?
I mean, right. So one, we don't know about the letter writer, how old the kid is, but one of the questions that came up for me really is sort of, there's this issue of what does a person do when they're done with a relationship and someone continues to reach out? Then there's this question of what do you do as a parent? How much are you supposed to be teaching your kid about how to end a relationship or to say you just have to be extra nice because this person's hurting or whatever? And I think there's a lot of layers here too. So Lynn, Gina needs your advice. Our letter writer needs your advice. What do you say?
I mean, I think you always have to be extra nice in life. That's just bottom line. But being extra nice doesn't mean you have to be friends. I think those are two different things, you know? And, you know, I don't have this specific situation with my older one, but I do know that actually both my kids go in waves about their sort of interest and investment in friendships in general. And so, you know, my first thought when I was thinking about this was to be able to say truthfully, you know, you don't want to, I think like to just get the, let them take the hint is like hard pass. No, because, you know, you put yourself in the shoes of that parent, you know, who is probably struggling with this and getting, and supposed to, probably there's other parents out there who are hoping that she takes the hint and like, ugh, like, I don't, that to me is painful, but I, you know, I could say truthfully, like there's literally no way I would be able to get one of my kids to be like, okay, I'll just do it. Like there's no way, but that's okay. Like you can't force anyone to do anything. That's not particular to my kids. That's why the previous person can't like convince is the, you know, is the wrong approach. But anyway, I was thinking that one thing, if it were me, I could truthfully say about either of my kids that they are a little funny about how they're dealing with friendships now. And they're not kind of managing friendships the way we do. They don't manage friendships out of, like, they don't do what you think we would do. They just kind of they're weird about it. And they don't necessarily, even the kids they like and are longtime friends with, don't always do the things that we would do to nurture those friendships. Like, I can't promise that I can get my kid to come through, not because of you, but because I can't, like, they're being weird right now.
I got it. So Khan, I want to ask you to think about this on a couple of, first of all, I'm interested in, as someone who's doesn't have kids, what you think of that question directly, but I'm also really interested in just from, let's just be real, right? We're grownups and sometimes we're done with some friendship and somebody's kind of still. So I'm also interested in how you've handled that or how you would advise people to handle that. I mean, do we have to keep being friends with people we don't like because we're grownups and not kids? I don't know.
Yeah. Wow. I got to say, you know, sometimes when I'm on the podcast, which is like really, really fun and very, you know, it's not just entertaining. It's, I feel like I'm with two rabbis. And this is like one of those moments where I go like, oh shit, I better listen. Cause like, I need this advice. You know what I mean? Like without even realizing I need it. So this was like one of those moments for me where I was like, oh my God, pay attention. Like you, and
are you breaking up with me, Khana? You don't want to be friends with me anymore?
Well, so that's the thing, Sofana. Like, right. Do friends, and I don't know, this is like a question for everybody here. do friends break up when it's not a huge thing? Like, does are friends like going to coffee and like hanging out and then like it's starting to fizzle, but then someone says, you know what? We're starting to fizzle. Like that happens in, I think, romantic relationships, but I actually don't have any experience with platonic friendships ending the same way. Like we don't break up like that. We break up friendships when shit goes down. Ooh, sorry, I can't see that. Like we that's when friendships.
Well, Connor, what were you starting to say? I think you were starting to say that you've got some issues. You want to break up with some people or something.
It's a safe space.
Well, a couple of things. One, I was actually reminded of a letter we had from the 1922. It was called like the Montreal Sister, the Quarreling Montreal Sisters. And I think it is kind of relatable in a way. It's just, you know, two early immigration sisters. One came from Europe before and let the other one live in the house. And you know, it's going fine for a while. And then it just like falls apart. And the same kind of thing, like one is not fulfilling the needs of the other, and they, you know, and they write to the forward in like desperation. And the forward is just like, you know, you need to separate, and you will find that when you separate, you will then get along well. And the other thing they said, which to me is like about boundaries, like everybody has to learn to make boundaries. You know, I don't have kids, but I was thinking about cousins because I have like, you know, Baruch Hashem, we were blessed. There's like, you know, 20 something million on one side. And like, you know, there's just like first cousins. So those were my first friends. And like, maybe it's a little easier with cousins because I wasn't in daily life together, but certainly, you know, Friday nights at my grandmother, like it, we're pretty tight as our-
And you know, you can't break up.
So right. But you have to learn to put a boundary down. And how do you do that? So that, you know, and there's this saying, famous saying, you know, chop with an axe. Like sometimes you have to chop with an axe, but you have to kind of know the difference, you know, but sometimes you do have to do that. And also like say what you mean, but don't say it mean, you know, I'm not saying I'm good at any of this. If anybody who knows me, who is on that chat, who will be hearing about it, I'm not great at this. So I was kind of listening with intent because, you know, it's frightening. But I did want to say to Gina, like, it's true that, you know, a lot of times friendships just go down when, you know, they break up when there's like a very obvious reason and the whole thing just blows up. But there's also kind of what I think we're alluding to here is like the ones that just kind of, I don't know, they just kind of fizzle out. And it's like it's like an existential thing. You're like, we don't have anything in common anymore, you know. And that's like a harder thing, but it does bring grief. There is grief.
I think this happens all the time with adults where people are like, I don't know if I did anything to offend that person. I think they don't like me. It kind of just fizzled out, and you really have no idea if something has happened, if either you've offended them or they've just decided, you know, you're too loud or whatever, they don't like you. I'm talking to myself, obviously.
I was gonna say, whoa.
or like they're busy, or like, you know, their parent is ill. I mean, no idea, because no grown-ups ever talk to them. Nobody would ever call you up and be like, honey, I'm done. Like,
exactly.
And why not? Maybe we should.
Yeah.
That's my point, Jody, is that they just fizzle, is that we don't call the bestie or the former bestie and say, you know what? We actually haven't been to lunch in 2 years. So maybe we should just call, like, we don't cut the ties unless something big forces us to, and there is a moment of that sort of that division, that cut. That's what my point was, is that we don't treat them the same way.
So we have a question that's really important from one of the audience members who is pointing out that we are talking from some really privileged places here. She says that she does not have a partner, children, or a dishwasher. Not everyone is upper middle class, which is of course true. And asks, what advice would you give to single people struggling with the isolation of the pandemic? Coupled friends often don't understand how challenging life is for people living alone.
Yeah, we actually had a question about that earlier in the season. That's a really great question. It's a really great question. You're right to ask. I mean, part of me is wondering, this is not an answer, but for context, I mean, things are getting a little better. And also, we also talked earlier on about all the different ways to build community and what the definition of community is. And how that is, you know, is evolving. and how there are, you know, so many different ways for people to access and be part of communities that are, thank God, exist, that don't, that, that mean that we don't have to walk over to the Forward Building, you know, to find community. So that's one, that's a, that's sort of the start of an answer. It's not an answer, but it's a, it's the landscape of an answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's really huge, is that the pandemic has created additional ways to connect. And then I also recognize that not everyone can connect digitally too. Like, you know, many of us are like, oh, you know, I know so many people who were like, oh my gosh, the pandemic has freed me from the anxiety of going out into the world. I can like be behind my Zoom, I can be in my pajamas. And so, I, you know, there's pluses and minuses of both. And I think that I'm at this Musar retreat with, you know, a million of other folks. And, you know, one person, we were talking today about, like, we did this exercise where we were talking to God. And one of my fellow retreat folks was like, you know, I live alone. And this last year actually endowed me with the ability to have this conversation with God, because I've been having conversations with myself for a year. And so I'm actually better equipped to be like, to think more deeply and to think this Musar way, right? That we're being encouraged to think about this week. And so, I mean, I do think there's an element of what can we all do in this moment in time, not just people who are single and living alone, but what can we all do to make ourselves the people we want to be when we can get out into the world and we can go back to the way it used to be? And like, is there some self-improvement? Like, I'm doing that right now. I'm going to do some self-improvement stuff right now. And I think that we can all do that. And like Lynn was saying, pursue some of these newfangled ways to do it that, you know, we used to have to go down the street or go somewhere or travel. And now we can access a lot of opportunity without having to actually leave our home.
You know, and what are the old-fangled ways, right? Like our block here in Brooklyn includes several multi-generational households, including this one right here. My in-laws are downstairs right now. Many, there's actually four or five families that have three generations in on our block. And we, this may not be accessible to everybody, but the point is we actually, we always had a pretty cohesive block, but even more during the pandemic, we were out, you know, we just, everyone, we had a thing where everyone came outside around 6 o'clock and just chatted, you know, we have musicians on the block. They would play music, and all the generations, little kids, the grandparents, you know, were not a block party, but people were out and it was intentional.
I want to ask you to weigh in on this because you left New York City during the pandemic and now live with not a lot of people around you, right? And you have a partner, but I'm interested in how you're making new connections and keeping old connections and how you're finding this.
Yeah. Well, first, can I just like, I just want to shout out to the Q&A, to the person who wrote us that, I have a lot of empathy for that. And I certainly understand. I live really far away from my, you know, my family of origin, which is like great on many, many levels. But I'm also going into like year three of not having visited my mom. And it doesn't feel really good. It, like, I'm going to cry in a minute. And I don't know what to do, you know, so I have some compassion. I have lots of single, delightful friends who are, you know, I'm watching them navigate this. And it's just like, I get so much courage from them. And also, I want to say about the class stuff, the paper was founded as, you know, as the paper for the working masses, the working Jewish masses. And I just want to say that, you know, please, I encourage you to read our site and attend our things, because like, we do have that in mind all the time. You know, it's not a forgotten issue for the Forward at all. And those are most of the questions that make up the Bintel Brief. And that is the group of people who sustained us for over a century with the $1 donation, the $5 donation, you know, that's our history and we stand by it. And as for, yes, I moved out of the city, but I mean, a couple of things. And also I just want to say to all the single people out there, the individuals, don't assume that just because somebody's in a relationship, they do not experience loneliness, because sometimes that is the worst loneliness you can ever experience. And it starts with the dishwasher stuff we were joking about, but you know, you do have those moments where you're like, oh, wow, I am alone. So, you know, that's, yes. Okay. So I am in a rural, we moved to the Catskills and, my partner was up here before me already doing the reconnaissance. So I am the lucky one because I just slid into social life. Yeah. Super lucky. I should say too, she also cleans the house. That is an issue we are dealing with. Cause I feel like I work the harder job. So, and I love cooking, so, you know, whatever. Okay, so we have our issues, but like everybody, but you know, you do in a family, in a community, in a job, you can experience loneliness. It's, you know, so I guess I just wanted to also say that we, you know, as the pandemic sort of eased up a little bit and we could do stuff outside, we did have this phenomenal thing up here. There are Jews up in the Catskills still. And we invited, like, I think we had like 12 folks here for Rosh Hashanah lunch. And we found a little stream. My partner, Myra, found this little stream behind our house where people wanted to do tashlich. And somebody made brisket. Somebody made four challahs. So like they're just, and we just did it by reaching out to folks that we knew up here who were Jewish. We had some connection, but not a whole lot. And it was amazing to see a coming together around, you know, a Jewish identity-based item that that everybody seemed to need at this moment in time. And people are still talking to us about it. It was nothing fancy. It was like outside and some people were around the kitchen table and they wanted to be closer to the food. I don't know. But it was just like very, very, very moving.
Sounds,
and it
really
taught,
lovely.
Taught me about community building.
Yeah.
Sounds really lovely and very Hamish. So we are over time and I know people have to go. I'm just going to... So ask you guys, Lynn and Gina, to perhaps offer us some parting words, which I'm going to suggest might be like general life advice that can apply to all situations. So instead of the WWGD bracelet, this is what you might have tattooed on your forehead or on your bracelet of like, no matter what you're dealing with, start here. Mine, of course, is to sign up for the Ford newsletters. But
oh, that's so weird. That's what I was going to say. Okay. Okay.
No, I mean, maybe that's a crazy question, but it feels like the right closing question for an advice. You guys are now professional advice givers. Like, what's your essential core advice?
So I will say that my essential core advice is actually a question that I got, that I get from my dad, Jesse Green. I love him dearly. He, one of the things that drives me that I think I ask a lot every day is the juice worth the squeeze? So you're dealing with something, you got something to weigh, is what you're going to have to put in worth what you're going to get out?
No, the other thing is what you're going to get out worth,
right, what you're going to get out worth what you're going to have to put in. Exactly.
I got it.
You.
Okay, that's good.
You figured it out, Jenny. Is the juice worth the squeeze?
Is the juice worth the squeeze? I would put that on a t-shirt or a bumper sticker. What about you, Lynn?
I'm thinking about what my mother would have said right now. And one of them is definitely use the Oxford comma, but that's a little arcane. So I think what my mother would have said is never say to yourself, I shouldn't be feeling this way. Choose your actions separately, but feel how you feel. It's fine. And then decide what you want to do. That is what my mother, a blessed memory, would have said.
Connie, you got one? I don't need to put you on the spot for this one.
You know what? I was thinking, I'll just keep it short, but I just want to say we had to see a cardiologist recently. And when I was reporting back to my mom what happened, she said this thing to me. And I was like, that's basically my parents' life advice, which is like, she said, well, if you liked him, make friends with him because he could be helpful. So basically, I would say she was saying, talk to people. Both her and my dad, a blessed memory. Talk to people.
So wait, okay, so... is the juice worth the squeeze? Never say to yourself, I shouldn't be feeling this way. And if you liked him, be friends with him. He could be helpful someday. I love those. We're going to make it through the desert with these, you guys. We are going to be okay. Thank you everyone for joining us. Please do sign up for the newsletter. Please do go listen to the podcast. Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Gina. Thank you, Hannah. And thank you, Aaliyah Smith, who's hosting this and making it possible today. It's great to have you. It's great to be with you guys. Have a great night.
We hope you enjoyed that live advice-a-thon as much as we did. And thanks for being there. If you want your question answered in a future Bintel Brief podcast or live event or augmented reality where we beam the answer right into your brain, you never know. Please email bintel@forward.com or call us at 201-540-9728. If phones still exist. Thanks to Edward Blank for making this podcast possible. This podcast is a product of The Forward. Our editor-in-chief is Jody Redoran, and our CEO and publisher is Rachel Fishman Feddersen. This show is produced by Wonder Media Network. Our producer is Ira Simonson. Our production assistant is Carmen Borca Carrillo. Our executive producer is Jenny Kaplan. Special thanks again to Edward Blank, whose generosity makes this show possible.